Now, I just got a letter from the editor of a journal who takes Joseph Smith to task for teaching in 3rd Nephi the very same things that Jesus taught in the old world. Is Brother Warren here? Derek Warren? Hi, just coming in. Are you Brother Warren? Did you hear what I just said? Did you catch that jewel I just dropped? Well, I'll drop it again. Oh, here we come. Somebody tells me in a letter, what I get, editor of a Catholic journal, he says, Joseph Smith is merely repeating the New Testament in 3rd Nephi. It's just the same old story. Well, what would you say to that? What did he say about that? He explained why he was telling them those things, and what did he say? Remember, he said, these are the same things which I taught the Jews in Jerusalem. Now, here's the question. Would you expect him to teach something different? Why not? Ah, there you are, you see. Give that man a cigar. Here we go, then. So we go on. But it is a different in form, and it has a different emphasis. And each chapter has a clear-cut theme, and the whole leads to a transcendental conclusion, a terrific conclusion, which is not found in the New Testament. Remember, the apostles thought it was all over after the crucifixion, and strangely enough, the ministry, the churchmen today, still think it's all over, that anything that happened after that was a fond imagination of the followers of Christ who created from a beautiful memory, they created the figure of the Christ as the super, etc. That's the general form taken today. Well, now let's look at chapter 11. I said each chapter has one particular, usually a particular theme that carries through. And chapter 11, we don't go through this again. In chapter 11, you notice, he introduces himself. It's a surprising way he comes down and does it, isn't it? And he helps them get over the shock of adjustment. You'd think that would be something, wouldn't you? And then the next chapter, he does what you'd expect, takes the next step. He sets up teachers, states qualifications for membership. The Beatitudes, Sermon on the Mount, blessed are those who will you admit to the church. In the New Testament, too, people don't notice the Sermon on the Mount is not just moral platitudes, not at all. It's addressed specifically to the disciples, to his apostles, just to them. Who will be permitted into the church? And these are the qualifications. And he tells us here, it's a very important thing, that it's not the letter of the law, but the spirit, you see. The letter killeth, but the spirit doeth life. Does that abolish the scriptures or something like that? No. Brother Walt Fogel? Brother Walt Fogel. Isn't there a contradiction there? The letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life, and yet we're supposed to read the scriptures. Well, that's exactly what we're told in the 7th or 8th section, Doctrine and Covenants. Talk about translating the 93rd section, excuse me, I think, translating the Apocrypha. He says, there are many things therein, which is true of the scriptures, which are interpolations by the hands of men. There are many things therein which are true. Well, how do you distinguish between them? It makes it rather desperate. That's why you have to take the doctrine that every word of the New Testament, of the Gospel, was dictated directly by God. If you leave that out, then at any moment there might be something wrong in the scriptures, something that men interpolated. Well, this is taken account of in this section of the Doctrine and Covenants. Therefore, he who reads by the Spirit can understand, can benefit therefrom, it says. And if you don't have the Spirit, it's not going to help you very much because you give it the literal interpretation. Now, this is brought out very clearly in the New Testament. What is the argument that the Lord has with the scribes and Pharisees and the doctors of the law, Brother Walt Fogel? What's wrong with their teaching? The reasons of men, but what should they go by then? That's it. He tells them, remember, he says, you tax the mint and the rue, you make the tithes, this is all careful, this should be done, he said. That's true, you should keep careful accounts, and that should not be left alone, he said. But you are blind leaders of the blind if you choke on a mosquito, stranger than that, and swallow a camel. The big thing, the mosquito is there, don't choke on that. The camel is the big thing, you see. And then he says, it goes on, the love of God is the important thing here. If you have that, it's the esprit de loi, isn't it? It's the spirit and intent of the law, which, as the prophets say, someday in the future this will be written in their hearts. Moses had it written on the tablets of stone, and they have to follow it rigorously, pointing our minds forward. This is all preparation. Everything we're doing here is preparation to the gospel is preparation all the way along. And we haven't prepared nearly enough yet. But see, we have to prepare by observing. We say we observe the laws of Moses, though we knew they did not bring salvation, we're told, Moroni says. But they pointed our minds forward, is the expression he goes, pointed our minds forward. Just as Frank Cross calls the Dead Sea Scrolls the church, the community of Qumran, the church of anticipation, because it looks just like a Christian church, but it's in anticipation, and they say it's in anticipation. They're out there in the desert waiting for more revelation. So we get the same thing here then, and it is then the letter of the law is superseded by the spirit and intent of the law. You know, for this intent the law was given. The Jews in the old world, as we know, had become legalistic and Pharisaical. And the lawyers, what about the lawyers in the new world? The lawyers have laid the foundation for the destruction of this people, he says. They're working hard at it now. Well, now the 13th chapter here. The word reward, notice how, this has another theme. You notice how often the word reward is repeated in chapter 13, first verse. You give your arms to men, you'll have your reward here, but don't expect any reward there. No reward of your Father in heaven. Next verse, verily I say unto you, they have their reward now. He doesn't resent their having it. If you want rewards for being famous, if you want to become renowned in Hollywood or something like that, you're welcome to it. But that's all you're going to get. You're not going to get anything further out of it. The next verse. The third verse, when thou doest alms with thy left hand, that thine alms may be in secret, that thy Father, who seeth thee in secret, shall reward thee openly. Reward thee openly how? In the next world, in this life, or with your own prosperity and so forth. But you know where it's coming from. You know who to thank for it and so forth. You're dealing. But you don't advertise your good deeds. You keep them covered. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing the other way around. And the Lord will reward you. You'll have your reward all right. And then, either here or there. And then you hypocrites, play in the streets that they might be seen of men. Well, you'll be seen, you'll be appreciated, you'll be praised, you'll be famous, so you'll have your reward. All right, happy you. And so the next verse, see, when you pray, enter into your closet, when thou shut the door, don't play openly on the rooftops and so forth. Nephi did, though, didn't he? He did that for a purpose. And thy Father who seeth in secret shall reward thee openly. Blessings cannot be concealed, actually. But where does it come from? How do you do it, you see here? But always talking about these rewards here, and he's talking about vain repetitions. So what would we say the theme of this chapter is? It's where our values lie, isn't it? Is it this world and the other? Think only of the eternal order of things. This is the surprising thing. We want to compromise. You say, we can have it here and we can have it there. We can be respectable. We can live in fine houses and so forth and so on. Be blessed here. After, but just the New Testament emphasizes repeatedly, and this does it again. Don't think too much of this one. Don't put anything because this world and everybody who knows it. I mean, omnia fia nihil expedit, as the emperor says, Emperor Septimius Severus, who from being a sergeant of the army became the most powerful and destructive emperor the Romans ever had. And on his deathbed, he says, "I've been everything, and nothing's worth a damn." And that's true. You reach the same conclusion as Citizen Kane there. You see, you go crazy. You're not going to get any satisfaction there. But so this is the reward we want. So he keeps that. Think only of the eternal order. Take no thought of the others, the things of this world. Forget appearances. And then the Lord's Prayer comes in this particular chapter. And it is... Well, we know, again, you see, well, notice how it emphasizes space here. The emphasis on the Lord's Prayer is on space or distance all the time. It begins with our Father. So we have a Father and he's ours, you see, but he's in heaven. He is in the heavens, as it actually says literally here, in the heavens. It's talking about always spaceless and closeness. And then, hallowed be thy name. There's the connection. See, if a person isn't there, how can you refer to him? How can you call upon him? How can you know him? How can you phone him? Unless you know his name, you're not going to get through at all. The name becomes extremely important as identity between parties who are separated. You see, when we're brought together at the veil or something, you must know a name. You must identify yourself. You're identified by your name, and how do you address the Father? By his name, which must be held set apart, sacred, secret. It's a secret name, of course, in the temple it is. The high priest in the temple in Jerusalem, the high priest uttered the secret name, which is written with the secret letters that nobody knows, only once a year in a whisper as he went through the veil. And he gave the name to his son, but no one else ever learned it. So this particular name with which he exchanges with the Lord. So this is the point of contact, and our main tie to him is always the name. And then he says, thy kingdom come. It's an optative. It isn't here. We're praying that it will come. We're looking forward to it. We want it to come as soon as possible, but we are waiting. There is that distance always. And again, thy will be done on earth as it is not now. Again, another optative, that may thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Your will is done up there, not down here. Where his will is done, that is the kingdom. And when that comes, then his will be done here. But always this emphasis on the separation. We're talking about two worlds here. And then it's very interesting. Esenen case is the word who's used here, which does mean don't let us get too deep in sin. But and then the word risai, a very good word here, which means to snatch, to rescue, to pull a person out of the water or out of the fire or something, to rescue a person at the last moment. Don't let us go so far that we'll be destroyed. Don't, my temptation is greater than I can bear. Even Cain was delivered from that, you know, when he said, my punishment is greater than I can bear. And he says, lead us not into temptation, esenen Cain into temptation. Don't let us get too deep in temptation, but snatch us out at the last moment. Please don't let us go all the way. From that which is evil, or he who is evil, either one, from the evil one or evil doing. The worst thing is the evil doing, not the evil one, because we embrace him when we do evil. And then thine is the power, glory, and so forth, omitted from the late editions of the New Testament, the Nestle and so forth. But now, as I say, as Joachim Jeremiah showed recently in Palestine, that was the old archaic ending that all prayers to God had to have. Now, thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory. It has to end with a doxology. He wouldn't have left it out at all here. But they use that as an argument against the Book of Mormon. Now, you know, that shouldn't be in there. That's not in the original text of the New Testament. Well, it is in some of the texts. It's not in all of them, but it had to be there. Well, so we go on. That's the 13th chapter now, the Lord's Prayer. And how does it get through to him? This is a very interesting thing here. We mentioned here the laws of physics, which confine us to this earth. We can get away, but with the speed of light. But there are unknown laws of physics which ignore the limitations of such limitations. And we know that such laws exist. Just one more phrase I'll read. Just one sentence here from Hawking that shows this. When I pray to the Lord, do I think it's getting through to him in anything like a real sense at all? Well, these men are thinking about it very seriously now, and he says here, if one neglects gravitational effects, which I said, as Einstein and Poincaré did in 1905, one has what is called a special theory of relativity. However, this is inconsistent with Newtonian theory of gravity, which says that objects attract each other with a force that depends on the distance between them. This meant that if one moved one of the objects, the force on the other would change instantaneously. It wouldn't take 50 light years to change that plan, because the motion of every body affects every other body. Of course, he says this ties us completely. We'll never have a complete system, because he says we still can't solve the problem of three bodies. Some people know. We know two bodies by the laws of gravitation, but if you have three bodies influencing each other, you cannot predict for certain. We still haven't solved it. They worked 2,000 hours in Chicago in computers on it and came out with an approximate solution to the just of three bodies. That's all, not 300 billion trillion bodies or anything like that. So we're a long way from this. But the fact that we have a force here that gets instantly everywhere and is the strongest and weakest of all forces at once is just a parallel here. See, gravitation is so weak, it's 1 to the 42nd power weaker, we could add zeros for all day long here, than the weak force, which holds the atoms together. And yet, it is the power, so weak is that it crushes the universe. That power and that alone, because it never stops, it never weakens, it's always steady. They say that's going to bring the universe back together and crush it into a singularity that has no space at all, that contains all the matter in the universe. It is so powerful to do all that. Well, this is amazing. It's full of contradictions and everything. But the weakest force is the strongest. And then he said, instantaneously. Or in other words, gravitational effects should travel with infinite velocity instead of at or below the speed of light. Well, they tell us if bodies are to influence each other, the other three forces, there must be an exchange of particles. The particles are virtual. They don't really exist. They exist on paper, I suppose. But there must be an exchange of particles. So if gravitation is to have an effect, these two bodies are to affect each other, they must exchange particles, and that's the gravitons. They invented gravitons, but nobody's ever found a graviton. They're purely theoretical today. But something has to explain the fact that there is an influence that gets instantly everywhere. That's an astonishing thing. A billion light years mean nothing. The same thing will happen. So we're dealing with a strange situation here. Well, let's get to the next chapter here, with the 14th. You have decided for the other world, he's telling us here.
Sacrifice.
So don't confuse the two ways of life. Don't get them mixed up. He'd been talking about keeping them apart, you know. How do you know who else has got things mud? How do you know who's on the Lord's side? You see, we know if that's the case, if some people, he organized them into a church, as you know, right at the beginning, sets the disciples, apostles aside, and they're not called apostles here, they're disciples, but he sets them up, and so you have a church. How do you know who's really a saint? And so this is taken up a great deal in the Book of Mormon. When the case of the knee horse comes up, that's a classic. How can you tell? So who's on the Lord's side? This is addressed not only to the disciples, this is addressed to everyone, this chapter here. So that's what they're talking about. He turned again to the multitude. First thing, judge not. You're not going to judge anybody. That's not our business. Because by the measure you meet, you will be measured to you. It will be measured to you. You'll be judged by the measure you meet. Accept that. No, then here comes this. Why do you behold the mote that is in your brother's eye? A mote is a Brownian particle, one of those little specks that move in the sunrise, in a ray of sunlight. You see the dust-like particles that move there, those are Brownian particles that Einstein discovered, incidentally. And that's what you see in your brother's eye. You can even see that. But you have a beam in your own eye. The word they use for beam is a husk, a piece of dry grass or some piece of garbage that's been blown around. It's been something that's been blown around by the wind, and you get that in your eye, and you've really got something. You don't notice that in your eye, but you notice a little tiny speck in your... So don't judge anybody. Do not. You may be worse than anybody else. Or will you say to your brother, let me pull the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam in thine eye, and so forth. And then there's this again. In the sixth verse, you see, when you have something holy, what do? Keep it to yourself or something? You share it? No, these things are not, you grant that other people may have it, but don't try to force on anyone, but don't force it on others. But in this case, give not what is holy to the dogs, neither the pearls before swine, lest they tramp you under their feet. Now, does that mean they are dogs or swine? This is not an uncharitable statement at all. The words he uses is puppy dog, as he uses it when he's talking to the Samaritan woman. He says, yes, but the dogs can eat the crumbs that fall from the table. And the word canarian means a little pet, the family pet, the darling family pet. Well, you not only if you give the best, the choicest crumbs from the table, as little kids do, to the family dog, naturally the little doggy is going to get sick. It's not going to do him any good at all, no benefit whatever. You might like it and so forth. And the same thing, the pearls before swine, would they appreciate them? Would they do them any good, any benefit, whatever? You're not insulting the swine or anything like that. You don't hate them because they can't take pearls. Lots of people can. The same thing with the dogs here. I say there's no... the image is that of feeding some animal who's not going to be benefited at all. It's not going to benefit you. See, you're giving away something that's valuable to you. But be careful, it'll hurt you. It'll hurt the little doggy, hurt somebody else. What do you get? What do you want? Well, you ask for what you want, and you'll get it. You seek, and you'll find it'll be opened unto you. You settle for yourself. If you want anything particular, these things, you ask for it, and you get it. Remember when Wilkinson went up to Salt Lake once, he was raging and raving about a gift that had been given to the University of Utah by somebody who might just as well have given it to the BYU. He was a good member of the church, a lot of money. And Wilkinson stormed and ranted, and President McKay asked him, he said, did you ask for it? No, we never asked for it. All right, then. He asked for it, and he got it. So the Lord says, if you ask for it, you get it, but you have to ask for it first. You really have to want it. And you seek, and you shall find. You must seek first. See, there must be, as the Talmud says, there must be a stirring, a rajas. There must be a stirring below before there can be a stirring above. You do not ask a blessing on an empty table. You set the table and ask for the blessing. You make the stirring below. First, this had to do with Abraham. He moved first. He had the first move, as he tells us in the second chapter of the Book of Abraham, the 22nd verse, he says, thy servant has sought thee diligently, now he has found thee. But you had to seek him first, you see. You must seek first. You make the first move here. If you don't have that desire, if you don't have that yearning, because that's where you assert your own eternal individuality, your own spirit, that you're there and an independent being. So you make the first move, the Lord will meet you far more than halfway. And you knock, and it will be open to you. So what are you waiting for? It's all spread out before you, he tells us here. What, he says in the next verse, what man is there of you who, if a son asks for bread, will give him stone? It's all there. You can have, all you have to do is ask for it. Who do you want it, and so forth. And then, Then what? Then comes the beauty, the 12th verse, the golden rule. This covers it all, you see. Our one-to-one relationship. God says, if you want to please me, do as I do, you see. And this is the law and the prophets. Do what you would have done to you. And, of course, we don't do that. The eye for an eye won't do there, will it, anymore? But after all, and it doesn't appear just for the first time in the New Testament. We know that. The Chinese proverb, the same effect and so forth. You don't want anybody to hit you. Why should you hit them? Well, and then there are the two ways. And you're going to take the narrow way here, deciding who's on the Lord's side. The narrow way and the broad way. The two ways is a basic doctrine of the early church. And beware of the false prophets. Samuel the Lamanite talks about them in sheep's clothing. Inwardly, they are ravening wolves. We insist on judging by appearances, you see. Oh, we'd take them with their sheep's clothing. Again, we're judging by appearances. We'll get fooled if we judge by appearances. Beware of false prophet in sheep's clothing. He's been telling us all along not to judge by appearances. Now here's a good example. Don't take the chief. It works both ways, you see. Don't be taken in that way. And then the rule is, by their fruits you shall know them. Not everyone who says, again, you'll see lots of people claiming to be pious and in the church and all this sort of thing, everybody else. Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven. But he that doeth the will of my Father, that is the test, you see. And but they'll say, Lord, Lord, they can use his name. The name can be used by anyone. People, all other churches, they pray in the name of Jesus, the Lord. That's perfectly valid. They can receive answers to their prayers and so forth. But the Lord says, when they cast the devils out and so forth in my name, then will I confess unto them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. They use the name for that purpose, but they do not seek after, they do not follow his commandments. He says, that's the thing you have to do, what I'm telling you to do here. Well, this is where you distinguish who's who here, and nobody does. You have no means of knowing that I don't have a double life, a real humdinger, you see. And I don't know, have any means of knowing the same about you. Big surprises about everybody, you know. He has been living that way all his life. You talk, oh, I must read a poem of my son wrote some years ago when he was a little kid. It's a very good poem. On this subject. See, we can rave and rant against the evil, against sin in the gospel. The preacher can go on denouncing wickedness in the world and so forth. It doesn't affect people at all. I get away with murder. We can quote the Book of Mormon and so forth and all this, but everybody thinks it doesn't apply to them. People as different as Robert Redford and Senator Hatch, for example, both complimented me on the same book, you see. Very different point of view as far as that goes. They both read the book. They think it's wonderful, but it always applies to the other guy. So this is what Michael has written here. No, this is a good poem, just the same. When Anthony preaches, he goes to the beaches, converting the fish who can't make it to church. They swarm up to listen, a drip and a glisten, the trout and the minnow, the pike and the perch. Treat all as your brother, don't murder each other, for all of God's creatures are children alike. What a marvelous spirit. The minnows all cheer it. They whisper and glare at the murderous pike. They're the ones that get eaten, you see. The root of all evil, great tool of the devil, is love of possessions. You'd best do without. What a marvelous spirit. The pike love to hear it and cast a stern eye on the miserly trout. Work hard. Those who idle will bear harsh requital. Who shirks at his labors gets left in the lurch. What a marvelous spirit. The trout just revere it. They nudge one another and mutter, those perch. Eschew fornications and lawless relations, for sex unrestrained leads to sorrow and tears. What a marvelous spirit. The perch love to hear it. They glance at the minnows with snickers and sneers. The saint ends his preaching. The fish loves such teaching. They watch as his figure recedes from the shore. Then greed, lust, and slaughter resume in the water, and all is exactly the same as before. after all the teaching, you see. I think that's a neat poem for a little kid to write. We'll talk about Michael here. So, let's get the next chapter then. Rush on here. Now the 15th chapter, it answers this question. What is the overall plan? How does this affect the old law? What about Israel in the new world? This is the other sheep. This tells us a very important thing, that the plan of the Lord is from eternity to eternity and throughout all the immensity of space, but of course it's divided. It's divided into the history of this world, is divided into cycles, plays, acts, scenes, separate speeches and so forth. Each is a play in itself. The universe is divided up into various scenes where various things are going on. What has happened in worlds heretofore formed and worlds we have heretofore formed, exactly the same sort of materials and so forth. They have their dramas going on too. There are plays going on all over the place and at various stages of advancement. So this is introduced into this world. There's more than one place where the Lord appears and does his preaching. To more than one. This brings in the subject of world religions. We're not the only pebbles on the beach here. We claim to have the own religion. How exclusive and snooty we are. But what about these others? This takes up that, the overall plan. Christ personally here takes over for the transition in this earth, you see. We've got to make this transition to the way of life that was laid down for us in the beginning, that Adam agreed to, was taught by the angels. We have to agree into that. But we're going to have to go over a transition. We've drifted a long way, and the Lord is here personally to supervise that. And so, notice verses 12 following in the chapter 15 have to do with localizing and with a... coordinating the operations here. No, he starts right out here. Remember the sayings when they raised up. And they wonder about the law of Moses. Well, there is one law, but now you're living under another. It's the same one now, only now you're living, as we said, it completely. The law is fulfilled that was given to Moses. I'm he that gave the law in me is fulfilled. I do not destroy the prophets. They shall all be fulfilled. Oh, I didn't bring in my Doctrine and Covenants. There's a very good passage there that I could have brought in here. It comes in later, though. Old things have passed away, but you don't destroy that which has been spoken already. You see, old things have passed away. We love to destroy things. That's the great weakness here. You see, we have this turnover. We build a building with the intention of build a $100 million building in New York. I traveled around with an architect in New York, a friend of mine, quite an eminent person, and he showed me all these buildings. He said, this was built, his son designed it. He says, this was built... to be destroyed, to last for 30 years. It was going to be torn down in 30 years. That's progress, you see. It's the way we do these things. Must all the old things be done away with this way? Don't we have some continuity? Remember, it's like memory. Without memory, you have no identity. And we throw away our memory. We throw away our past as we go along. So the America we just see today isn't the America of our fathers or anything like that. No attachment, no affection to it. We're like people with Alzheimer's. We've lost our memories. We're just going around doing the next thing, looking forward to the next moment. We think that's being up to date. That's being practical. Well, he's talking about this then, about the old law, which is still in effect. But the covenants have not all been fulfilled. I am the law and the light, the object of that law. Look unto me and endure to the end. See, the object of the law is to test us. This is the time of our probation here. This life became a time of probation. And endure to the end, and he that endureth will have eternal life. That's the object, to get this thing going on an eternal basis. And we're far from it now. If we were to partake of the tree of life now and live forever in our sins, it would be the ultimate tragedy. We would yearn to die. But no, we're preparing for that. So, if you endure, you see, if you pass through here, if you can hang on here to the end, then you'll have eternal life. But don't expect anything here. And then he speaks to the 12. You're a light unto this people. This is a promise to Lehi's children who really have a feeling for the land. Now, this is about this land. For the Gentile, it's a commodity. But for the Indians, it's sacred. I know I spent lots of time among them. It is holy. And their religion makes a very important thing of it. When Yigal Yadin was here, a little group of us were having an evening with him over at Kent Brown's house. And Yigal, Ali, the great Israeli, you know, the general in the Eighth Year War, the commander of the army, and also the head of Israel Antiquities. He just died a few months ago of Israeli Antiquities. He was talking about it. He said, what religion? What do you believe in? And he said, my religion is the land. That's what I believe in. It's the land. To me, that is sacred. That's carrying it pretty far, the land of Israel, Eretz, Israel. But there are lots of people who feel that way, that the land itself is sacred. No other land would do. There's something special about this place. But this inheritance is not the Gentiles. It's given to this branch of Israel. Behold, this is the land of your inheritance. The Father hath given it to you. It's yours. We use it as a commodity. And not at any time hath the Father given me commandment that I should tell it unto your brethren at Jerusalem when the Peabody Corporation bulldozed the sacred canyon of the Hopis, the Blue Canyon. Sad thing. It's a place where they used to meet. Developers, whom we have a lot of them now, accuse the Indians of pagan reverence for the land, you know, of being sentimental and romantic, whereas they are solid and practical. They're businessmen. We might fight to get a brief income from allowing nuclear waste to be deposited in there, and we do. There were parts of Utah where the people actually fought, got very nasty about people who didn't want nuclear waste to be brought in there and dumped there, because that mean they'd make money for a few years. But then for 50, 60, 100,000 years, the land couldn't be walked on. It'd be no good at all. That didn't count. They want the money the same way, you see. We call Palestine the Holy Land, yet we scoff at the Indians for believing their assigned portion of the land is holy. And they have their holy rocks, as you know, and canyons and streams and particular things. And the Greeks the same way. The ancients had the same way. Would you call that nature religion? Well, there's an awful lot of that in the Pearl of Great Price, especially in the Book of Ether, Book of Enoch, and so forth. We're not talking about that now. But he makes it very specifically. This is your holy land. Now, there are other tribes the Father has led away. He's calling them a tribe. There are other sheep I have which are not of this fold, and we know this passage too. And there shall be one fold and one shepherd. That's the thing. This is to bring them together here. And the stiff-necked of the Jews, they didn't understand what I was talking about. Ye were separated from among them because of their iniquities. You're going to be rehabilitated. This is the Rechabite principle. It's, you know, we have to get out. This is the people in the Dead Sea are preaching this. We left wicked Jerusalem so they could live the pure law. The only way we could do it was to get out of town by ourselves. And this is what's happened again with the Rechabites. We are separated from among them. Other tribes the Father has separated from them. This is the process, you see. Because of their iniquity, they know not of them. So we're all living in separate because we're not righteous enough to associate. If we associated with each other in a corrupt state, we'd corrupt each other, wouldn't we? And so I say unto you, ye are they of whom I said, other sheep I have. They shall hear my voice, and it shall be one fold of my shepherd. They didn't understand me. But the Gentiles should not at any time hear my voice, save it were by the Holy Ghost. That they can have, you see. The rest, they can become Israel. We can see how they can become Israel. Now he carries this through in the next chapter. What about the rest of the human race, we ask? Well, no one is denied. Here we have accommodation with the Gentiles. Since it's the same gospel, all must be given a chance to get into it. And so we have this in this chapter, which is so packed with history, as we see, prophecy. It's the one is up and then the other is down. The Gentiles up and then notice how it goes here. In the fourth verse, the Jews are out and the Gentiles are in. Israel benefits. In the sixth verse, the Gentiles are blessed. In the seventh verse, Israel is out and the Gentiles are in. In the eighth verse, some of the Gentiles are unbelieving. They're out. They're out in the promised land. And Israel is scattered. In the eighth verse, everybody is out. The Gentiles have become unbelieving and Israel is scattered. In the ninth verse, the Gentiles are up and Israel is down. In the tenth verse and the following, the Gentiles begin to slip. In the 11th and 12th verse, Israel is taken back again. In the 13th verse, the Gentiles are given a last chance, a chance at any rate. In the 14th verse, Israel is held back to give them the final chance. See, in the 15th verse, the Gentiles refuse the gospel. Israel is unleashed. In the 16th verse, Israel gets the promised land. It's up and down, in and out, back and forth. Now, this is repeated in some of the chapters that follow to make first and clear what he's talking about here. We've gone rather fast with that. That's what we're doing. What I'm asking you to do is read this through carefully and see if that isn't so. See who's up and who is down. But this is thus he commandeth the Father, at that day when the Gentiles shall sin against my gospel. This is the ultimate prophecy in the Book of Mormon. This is the great warning, you see, that 10th verse. Will a part remain and so forth? Then, if they will not return, Israel shall go through among them and shall tread them down. Now, we have vivid imagery here, but we don't know what it is, what will happen. But this is very interesting. Jack Anderson has said all along, you see, he said all along. He says he's far more frightened of what will come up from the south against this land than the Russians could ever threaten us. He says the Russians don't really threaten us, and we see now they don't. But the threat will come when we're so weak they can go through us like a knife through butter, you see, this sort of thing. If our morals are weak, if our economy breaks down, since we have nothing to live for except the economy, there's nothing in our lives except that, you see, nothing to sustain us, what would happen when the economy comes? You have no idea how people were broken up and completely shattered by the Great Depression. It didn't faze the Hopis at all. They've always been living on dry sand and nothing else. They didn't lose a thing. They got through beautifully, just as hard for them today. But with us, suicides right and left, the most terrible things happening. I had a I had a project in sociology in which I had to consult with all the pastors in Glendale, California. What was going on in the churches and so forth. I got some very interesting things. Their morale had completely collapsed just because the economy wasn't holding up. Who cares about that, you see? Well, but then he says, I should give unto this people this land for their inheritance. Then the 17th chapter is, after all this, this is marvelous. This changes the tone completely, this next chapter. This is the happy chapter. After this pageant of mounting conflict and folly, we reach the grand climax, Book of Mormon, and it's all good news. That's wonderful. Book of Mormon's the happiest book in the world. The terrible questions without the gnawing doubts are here, you see. And that's this one here. After all, we're just one loving family, he says. Christ wants it that way. He sets the example. This is this great intimacy in the church. Jesus, remember, when he comes, he talks. He prays, he eats, he converses, he even weeps with them. It's everything they do. When they kneel on the ground, he kneels on the ground. And he heals them all. And then it's the children's turn now. They alone offer no opposition. Most of this chapter belongs to the children, too. But he starts at the beginning and says, the beginning of the chapter, this isn't just a display. I'm not just telling you, just putting on a show here. This is something to exercise your minds on. You've got to think about this. He says, now, I see you cannot understand all my words. It isn't just as you hear it that you're impressed by this sort of thing. Star Wars, I say, the special effects. It's not it at all. He says, you don't understand what I've been talking about, do you? He says in the second verse, all my words. So what? This is what you do. You go home and concentrate. You ponder about it, upon the things I've said. And you ask the Father, and you pray that you can understand it. And ask the Father in my name that you may understand this thing and prepare your minds. You see, we think if we accept the gospel, a missionary goes out, a family is baptized, or now they're in church and so forth. We have a long way to go here. It's something to exercise the mind. It requires understanding. And you must prepare your minds. Now, these people were the righteous. They'd grown up in the church. They'd been baptized. They were those that weren't destroyed. The others were in the church, too, but the church was corrupt in their part. But they didn't understand when the Lord came. They didn't understand the words any more than the apostles understood the words after the Lord spoke to them after the resurrection. And then we're told, remember, at the end of Mark, Luke, and so forth, when he spoke to them, then their eyes were opened, and they began to understand it. We don't have what he speaks, what he's taught to them, but this is what he taught to them. This is what he taught to the apostles after the resurrection. So he's speaking to his disciples here, too, remember? And so this is the story. This is the New Testament we have. This is the most valuable part of all, the gospel of the 40 days that we have here that he preaches, which is missing from you. But it had to have that preparation. It had to give the first part. He says, this is what I taught the Jews, and I'm giving it to you now. So, ponder these things, think about them, prepare your way. You must make an intellectual effort. It isn't that you just sit around and, now I go to serve myself to the lost. He's going somebody else now. Next verse, he's going to the lost tribes. This is a new vista. This is beyond Jerusalem, beyond Zarahemla, beyond the Wasatch. It's lost tribes of Israel. We don't know where they are. The people didn't want him to leave. They were in tears. And then he talks about the next epiphany. His bowels are filled with compassion because he's leaving, you see. They weep in the New Testament, too. What will you do when you have gone, you see? And again, this separation of the Christian theology teaches there was none. After the crucifixion, it was the Christ spirit that suffused everywhere. It's just love in your hearts and nothing else. He's not talking in those terms only. And he's filled with compassion. And then he has any sick. He's going to heal all the sick there. Now, this is an interesting thing. Your faith is sufficient that I should heal you. Remember, he couldn't heal them unless their faith was sufficient. It's a very important thing. Remember, it happened during his mission. He could not do miracles upon them because of their lack of faith. Remember when he went to his own hometown. And so, I see that your faith is sufficient that I should heal you. So, with one accord, they went forth and brought their sick. You can be sure of that. And he healed them, every one. Now, the preaching of the gospel is not a medical mission. Notice, he's healing them so they'd be able to hear the gospel the next day. He was going to teach them the next day. He's going to bring them all together. They're to be washed up and prepared for it. They're all to be not only healed, but they're to be baptized again. They'd all been baptized. Nephi's ordered to baptize them all again. Everybody is going to have to be in there, cleaned up, washed up, and healed of any disease. And then they're ready to hear the gospel. Then we're ready for it, you see. But we say medical missionaries and things like that do a wonderful work, like the Seventh-day Adventists. But the gospel begins where the healing ends, you see. Once you've been healed, the Lord says, heal them, feed them, and then you preach them, as he preached to the multitude. He fed them, and then he preached to them. And that was the bread they really liked. He said, then I'll give you bread that you'll never be hungry again if you eat this bread. And so this illness is actually a distraction. The gospel requires concentration. It requires health. These are prerequisites, but they're not the goal of the Christianity. They're the preparation to hear it, to hear the gospel. He's going to teach them that. And so then he commands, before he leaves, he commands the children should be brought. All this concern with the children, they're the only ones that can be reached. We have to start with them again, you see, with this new generation. Just as the great corruption came with the new generation a few chapters back, right in 3 Nephi, where it says, the new generation had grown up not knowing the gospel. And they were lured away by the Nehors and the Gadians. They found it was romantic. The young kids found it was romantic to be robbers in the mountains and so forth. They joined up in great numbers, these secret societies. This is the sort of thing that happens, you see, like Satanism and all this nonsense. Well, but now he commands that their children should be brought. He set them down upon the ground round about him. He stood in the midst, and the multitude gave way till they had been brought to him. He commanded the multitude to kneel down on the ground, and Jesus groaned within himself and said, Father, I am troubled. See, this is the thing. These you'd think would be the most righteous people in the world. But can't the human race ever get going? Must we always louse things up this way? You see, this is the point. Why do we have to, when we're capable of such tremendous things, to settle for such a shabby bargain we make? It's amazing. Well, he set them down upon the ground, and he commanded the multitude that they should kneel down upon the ground. And he groaned and said, Father, I'm troubled because of the wickedness of this people, of the house of Israel. They are the ones that should be more righteous. It's the contrast between them and the innocent children that is so moving here as far as that goes. And he himself also knelt on the earth. Here's Christ, the resurrected. He is kneeling upon the ground. He prayed to the Father. Remember, Moroni didn't touch the earth when he appeared to Joseph. His feet were above the ground. He didn't touch it. He was a messenger from above, come to deliver a message. But the Lord had come down here to take to take us into his arms. He's going to be one of us, one of the family, you see. And he goes all the way. And he prayed, and what he prayed cannot be written. Now we're getting out into these other dimensions, you see, which you can't describe. We know they exist and so forth, like a singularity. But this is what we're talking about here. But they bore record of it. When he says it can't be written, is he saying it is impossible or it's not permitted? If it can't be written, either we're forbidden to write it, or we can't write it. If we'd write it, you'd misunderstand it. So he's not going to talk that way. This is a demonstration of what is available to the undefiled human race as such. Not a sentimental interlude here. And then, and we heard Jesus speak unto the, yes, these great and marvelous things as we saw and heard Jesus speak unto the Father. And notice what the theme is. What is this theme here? Notice, again, we have one of those passages where every verse in succession sounds the gong on one particular word, and the word here is what? Can you find the word in the next 1, 2, 3 four verses? The same verb is the center of each of the next three verses. What is the word? No one can conceive of the joy which filled our souls. We needed to pray for it. And he arose, and but so great was the joy of the multitude that they were overcome. And it came to pass, he spake unto them and bade them arise, and they arose from the ground. And he says, Now behold, my joy is full. The theme is joy here. They're rejoicing. This is the happiest possible time they're talking about here. So the theme is joy. And what is harder to support? Great joy or great sorrow or great pain or great suffering or great fear? Which the joy is the hardest, you see. You have to be pure and righteous, I suppose, to suffer great joy, because it's the hardest thing to take of all. That's what we run away from. We fear it. We, as I say, we can suffer the way they do in the Moscow art theater. Stradach, you must suffer to produce a work of art and so forth. We're great sufferers like the Russians. No end to what we can suffer. Unlimited. But joy is a thing that scares us. This is something. It's a very interesting thing that a friend Hawking here says there are certain things that cannot be defined or conceived that are very real in the universe. And he gives us the best example, joy. He says you can't confine it, you can't define it, you can't tell somebody else what it is, and you can only take so much. It will knock you out. How much sweet can you take? How much sour can you take? How much of a particular kind of food can you take? Well, joy is strong medicine. It's powerful stuff. And we're preparing to be able to receive it, you see. We'd wither up if we had to receive it now. It sounds like a paradox, isn't it? But if we were righteous, then we could receive the joy without the guilt. See, it's when the joy we're not worthy of is upon us, we feel guilty as hell. So it's no joy at all. So we're on with the paradoxes, eh? So he took the children and he wept. And the multitude bear record of it. And he took the little children one by one. Again, never the plural. Even the children are blessed one by one. And when he'd done this, he wept again. And of course, we read that passage from when Enoch asked the Lord, how is it that you can weep? He said, when I consider what opportunities I placed before Adam in the garden, what I gave you in the garden, I gave Adam, he says, I gave him his agency, and I gave him the necessary knowledge, and I even gave him commandments, what he should do, that they should love one another. But behold, they are without affection. They hate their own blood. And here, so God weeps here, and therefore shall the heavens weep. And this earth has to be destroyed, and all the other earths weep for it, because when what happens in one part of the universe affects all the others. This is right out of, you see, this is right out of our quantum mechanics, isn't it? One thing affects all the others. They all contribute to the others. They all exchange particles, actually. Everybody's exchanging particles with every other. It's an amazing theory, isn't it? When he'd done this, then he wept. And he said, behold your little ones. And why wouldn't you weep about that? Do you realize that 40,000 children a day die of hunger? That's what the figure is. I don't know that that's hard to realize. It's talking about Africa and Asia and so forth. 40,000 a day is the average of these little children. And remember what the Lord says, woe unto him who offends one of these little ones. It were better he had a millstone tied around his neck than were dropped in the sea. That should happen. And it's the little ones we offend. We make them, look at the child abuse. Look at the child neglect in our society. It's the rising, it is the most alarming and increasing statistics we have is the offense to the children, to the harmless, innocent children. Parents don't care about them. Nobody cares about them. It's a horrible thing. So this seems to be the normal procedure of the human race, exposure and all the rest of it. And Jesus weeps when he thinks of it because it's not the way things should be. And he says unto them, behold your little ones. And they cast their eyes towards heaven and the angels come and minister to them. And if we turn to the 17th, well, the 25th verse here, the multitude did see and hear and bear record. And they know that the record is true, for all of them did see and hear, every man for himself. Well, and they did consist of men. The point is, when they ministered to them, it means, it explains elsewhere in the Book of Mormon too. They walked around among them and talked with them and conversed with them and comforted them and gave them blessings, which they would always remember and so forth. They ministered to them in that way. That's what angels do when they minister. They bring the word. Gabriel came. When he comes in 1 Luke, he says, behold, I've come to minister to you. And then he preached the gospel. And so they cast their eyes toward heaven, and they saw the angels descending in the midst of fire, encircled those little ones. They were encircled about with fire, and the angels did minister. Why did the angels finally agree to come down? Because the children were qualified to receive them, but the others weren't. The children could receive the angels. See, their conversation was with the angels. They mingled among them, and the multitude saw them, and here with the children, and bore record, and all of them saw every man for himself. There's the individualism again. They were in number about 2,500, men, women, and children. But they saw the angels minister to the children. There was nothing wrong with that. They could do that. You see, that's why Moroni had to come to Joseph when he was a child still. Bring words like Gabriel. Well, actually, what Gabriel says here in Luke 1:19 is, I have come to chat with you. That's what, and with Zechariah and Mary, he says that he uses the same word. He says, I have come, lalaisai means lalad, to talk with you. It's a regular Greek word for an intimate chat, an intimate talk. And in the 19th chapter, first chapter of Luke, in the 19th verse, the angel Moroni says to, who is absolutely struck dumb, nobody's seen an angel for 400 years, when he comes to Zechariah in the temple behind the veil, that's where it was, he says, I have come to have a conversation with you. I've come to chat with you, lalaisai. And he says the same thing to Mary. I've come, lalaisai. And he says to Zechariah, I've come as a religious guy to preach the gospel to you too. So they come and chat. That's what angels do when they come and minister. Well, I see the time is up now, and we haven't got through. I was going to take us up to the, yes, Moroni, to the end of 3rd Nephi. What we'll do is go through and hold the ground a couple of times, because it's a longish book. It has important things in it.